going to talk to you today about a group of moths on a common host plant and some correlates regarding their abundance. So I'm starting with a very commonly observed pattern that you see pretty much whenever you survey biodiversity, enumerate species in a given trophic level. And in this case, we plot it with each point is a species. Log scale on the y-axis is the percent of total number of individuals encountered. And they're just put in order of their rank. And the pattern that you see in almost any kind of system, plants, animals, coral reefs, is that a handful of species are very common. In this case, there's four species that are each more than 10% of individuals encountered. And then there's this long tail of very scarce species where most species that you encounter in the system, even if they regularly occur, occur at very low numbers and density. And so there's been a lot of theoretical development about the shape of these curves, how they're put together. Recently, a lot of the theoretical activity has been centered around promoting or arguing against Hubble's neutral theory. But what I'm interested in is looking at this pattern in a group of moths and seeing whether we can determine ecological and life history factors that explain this pattern. So instead of thinking of the species as points, I want to think about their full range of variation in life history and all the ecological interactions that are going on. So from that pattern, the two questions I'm interested in focusing on are if life history and ecological interactions can explain some of the observed abundance patterns, and then how well in this group of mostly generalist moths the differential fitness predicts their differential abundance. Just to step back and describe the system a bit, I'm working with, as I said, mostly broadly generalist caterpillars that, in this case, share a host plant, somewhat weedy maple called box elder, Acer negundo. And my advisor, Pedro Barbosa, and his lab group sampled this and some other forest trees very intensively for a number of years to develop a profile of the parasitism rates on different host plants. And what they also did was generate those nice abundance curves that you saw in the beginning. So the purpose of the study I'm talking about today is just to find these ecological or life history traits, if any, that are associated with differential abundance. And to think about what sort of things might be important, you kind of go back to basic population dynamics. And in sort of life table terms, what we're interested in is the growth rate of a population, so that's dependent on their survivorship, their fecundities, and related to their development time as well. And so I'm not doing multiple life table studies for all these different species, but I'm using these same sort of variables and looking at fecundity, relative growth rate on the host plant, and mortality. In this case, the mortality figure, even though we know there's a lot of mortality sources in the field, the one that we were able to have a lot of good data on is the percent parasitism, so that's what I'm using. So to collect the data, I light-trapped adult females, collected eggs from both the females and also lab-reared females that were mated. The relative growth rate information was developed by rearing caterpillars from eggs on the host plant in field-like conditions in the growth chamber, changing their leaves every other day. And the actual variable I'm using is simply the change in mass per time, so change in mass per day, corrected for the final mass, because there are very different sizes of these caterpillars, so there has to be a correction for that growth rate. And then finally, the parasitism rates, which were again developed in this long-term survey. Now, in doing this sort of comparative approach and thinking about species as points in a relationship, you can't ignore their shared evolutionary history. So in this case, there's two Acronychta species that are found in the host plant in very different abundances, one very regular and one not. But in considering whether fecundity or growth rate plays into that, it's important to look at their sort of shared evolutionary past. And so to do that, I'm using a method called phylogenetically corrected generalized least squares. Just rolls off the tongue, but that what it does is allow you to incorporate what you know about their evolutionary relationship into the error structure of a statistical model. And so what that looks like is if you take a simple regression model where you've got a response variable, this vector of abundances in this case. You've got an explanatory variable, a set of variables, in this case it's trait information. And then you have an error, which is usually considered residual experimental error, observation error. What the generalized least squares method allows you to do is put some structure, specifically the phylogenetic structure, into that error relationship. So you still have the residual error, but part of the error is explained by that phylogenetic hypothesis. And the goal, of course, is to estimate some kind of relationship. And if all goes well, you'll see a very nice arrangement like this, where abundance is predicted by one of these traits, in this case, fecundity. Hypothetical. Before I show you that relationship, I'll just display some of the variability inherent in the data here. So here on the left is the phylogenetic relationship of many of these species that are in the assemblage. And this was developed from published family and below level phylogenies, and the families were actually put together in relationships that are just coming out from the LEP tree project that Charlie Mitter is running out of Maryland. And you can see that there's a lot of difference in the different fecundities, but another thing to notice is that there are differences in variation as well. So the spread of some of these box plots is much bigger than others. Likewise with the growth rate information, there seems to be some influence of clade in terms of their growth rates. Geometrids down here, and the arctides up here. So again, this is just pointing that you need to incorporate that information about phylogeny into this comparative approach. So here's the actual data of fecundity. On the y-axis, you see the log of the mean number collected per year over that survey. And on the x-axis is lifetime output per female. So each point is a species. And as you can see, there's no correlation with mean abundance. However, with the growth rate information, there actually is a pretty strong positive relationship. Again, on a log scale, the y-axis. And again, corrected for size. So these are three of the very dominant species that you encounter very regularly on the host plant. They all have very high growth rates. And they're of different sizes. So again, this is corrected for size. And finally, parasitism rate. This point is actually representative of two species that were each collected, I think, four individuals over a very long time, and half were parasitized. So if you include that point, you do get a negative relationship, but but honestly, there isn't one. So parasitism does not appear to be driving abundance in this case, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. So in conclusion, the increased growth rate on the host plant does strongly correlate with abundance. The fecundity is variable, and the variance in the fecundity is also variable depending on the phylogeny, but it is not correlated with abundance on the host plant. And as I mentioned, parasitism is not either. Some other work that Pedro Barbosa has done looked at this parasitism by abundance interaction, and using simulation studies, they showed that actually the most common species, caterpillars, were actually being parasitized more often than their abundance would predict, which just supports the fact that that's not probably the driving factor in terms of their success on this particular host plant. So implications of this, from these data, it seems like the bottom-up forces are very important in terms of how these caterpillars are doing, which could be chemistry or leaf nutrients, and some other work I'm doing is looking into specific the nutrition of the leaves. This is a little backwards from how most people think about trade-offs or examining relative fitness, because usually what you do is take one herbivore species and test it on a bunch of different host plants to see if there's good nutrition on one and defense on the other, or if there's some sort of trade-off that way. But in this case, we're taking a bunch of different herbivore species on the same host plant. If there was some sort of trade-off, though, you might still expect to see a pattern in terms of growth rates and defense against parasitism. I just plotted that here quickly, but there, for the ones that we have a lot of data for, it doesn't seem like there is such a relationship. So this doesn't suggest there's a huge strategy trade-off going on. Finally, if growth on this host plant is driving abundance on this host plant, it might be the case that looking across a landscape or site level, that relative abundance in total for these generalist caterpillars might be driven by growth rates on a bunch of different host plants. So with that, I'd like to thank my lab members and field assistants. I'll take your questions. Yeah, actually, what I'm hoping to do is incorporate all these traits and their variances and the variance of the response in a more comprehensive way. So I'd like to look at that in terms of like a Bayesian approach where you can actually incorporate the range of the different factors in doing that. Yeah, I totally agree. This is very simplistic, and it's not going to be the end result, hopefully. I think, well, I don't have any data, so my speculation is that its predation is very heavy and probably not, well, I don't think of it, generalist predation, as being very differential among the different types of species, especially the dominant species. I think they all get hit pretty hard, but I have no data for